frequency hum. You could feel it through the floorboards like the buzz of an engine. Around me, the new astronauts, excuse me, the new ass-cans, milled about in uncertain patterns. The seven women nearly vanished among the 35 men they'd chosen. Why had I signed up for this? Nathaniel stood directly in front of me.
197 times 4,753.
936,341?
Divided by 243?
3,853.255144032922. How many decimal places do you want? The dress that the stylist had asked me to wear had a tight-fitted bodice. It had seemed to fit well enough when I'd tried it on, but now I could hardly draw a breath.
That's fine. Square root. To 5 decimals, if applicable.
At least I wasn't the only one who was nervous. 62.07459? Sabia Gochin paced back and forth, shaking her wrists out. She kept touching her hair as if she'd be happier to have it back in a ponytail instead of the bouffant it had been teased into.
What is the optimal pitch-over angle for the gravity turn when entering low Earth orbit?
Gravity turn. With what rocket engine and configuration? And what should the final altitude be? Bless him for trying to keep me distracted.
Jupiter class, with a dual Sirius engine. Final altitude would be...
He probably said more than that, but Clemens walked onto the stage and through the curtains. The uproar from the audience rose to critical. I closed my eyes and swallowed and swallowed and breathed through my nose and swallowed down the bitter acid that coated the back of my tongue. Not now, not now, not now, not now, not now. Nathaniel breathed into my ear.
1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 9.
That's wrong. I clung to him. The Fibonacci sequence adds the prior number to the current one, so it should be 3, 5, 8, 13. Oh, clever man.
I can do more bad math if that will help.
He gave me a squeeze and stepped back to look at me.
Just remember that the astronauts get to fly T-33s.
I snorted. Here I thought you were going to tell me to remember that you loved me.
Eh, you know that. But a T-33? A jet? I know where I stand in relation to.
Elma, we're up. Nicole grabbed my hand and pulled me with her to the stage. T-33s. Even as an astronaut candidate, I would get to fly a T-33 jet aircraft. As we walked onto the stage, I tried to hold the image of the cockpit in my head. The flashes going off were just lightning. I could keep this steady and hold the course. That image lasted long enough for me to make it to the table with the other women. They had us seated in front, with the men standing in 2 rows behind us like a frame. This was just another interview. It was just like the ones I'd given before. I'd even been trained this time. 3.14159265359.
T-33. Astronaut, astronaut, astronaut. T-33. Dr. York, what does your husband think about your new occupation?
A voice came from the front row. The speaker was a man with a rumpled gray suit surrounded by nearly identical men with rumpled gray suits. I had no idea that reporters had uniforms. Nicole kicked me under the table. I was taking too long to respond. He's been very supportive. In fact, he was backstage waiting with us before we came out. Clemens pointed to another reporter in the ubiquitous gray suit.
Why do you all want to beat a man to the moon?
Nicole leaned into the microphone.
I don't want to beat a man to the moon. I want to go to the moon for the same reason men want to go. Women can do a useful job in space. We aren't in a contest to beat men in anything.
Thank God for her. That was a great answer. Granted, there was one man I would happily beat to the moon, but mostly I just wanted us to get there.
What are you gonna cook in space?
Science. The word popped out of my mouth before I thought about it, and the room rewarded me with a laugh. Followed by a nice healthy dinner of kerosene and liquid oxygen. Betty leaned into the microphone.
And without gravity, I'm looking forward to souffles that won't fall.
That line got a bigger laugh than mine, and pencils scribbled across notepads. Clemens pointed to another reporter. I stopped trying to identify them in the crowd because their questions were all just the same inanity, and none of them had questions for the men.
What about your beauty regimen in space? Will you be able to use hairspray?
Sabia shook her head. We will be in a pure oxygen environment. Hairspray would be foolish. That list of questions that they had prepared for us? We got none of them. They'd have been better off giving us a coach for beauty contestants. The only thing they were missing was asking us how we would bring about world peace. Behind me, the men shifted weight, and I heard one of them mutter,
What about bra size? Does the IAC have any plans to include men or women of color in the space program?
The man who asked the question looked white with close-cropped dark curls. His suit was not rumpled, and he held himself with exquisite posture. I swiveled in my seat to watch Clemens. He kept his smile fixed in place and raised a hand as if he had a cigar in it. Changing the gesture into a wave of dismissal, he said,
The astronaut program is open to anyone who qualifies, but due to the nature of the mission, our standards are very high. These ladies are the best pilots on the planet, best lady pilots. Naturally, our new male candidates are also outstanding, and our focus today should be on these fine men and women. I don't want to hog their spotlight.
Then I'll ask the ladies a question.
The man turned to stare at the stage, finding each of us with his clear, hazel gaze.
Would any of you object to serving with a black woman in space?
Everyone froze a little. It felt like a trick question. I leaned toward the mic. I would be delighted, and know several black women who are brilliant pilots. Betty recovered next.
I wouldn't object, of course, so long as the standards aren't lowered.
Being angry always helps control my anxiety. Ida could outfly Betty. Imogene was a better pilot than me, and goodness knows Violette shouldn't even be on the stage. We wouldn't have to lower the standards.
Now, ladies.
Clemens stepped toward us, dragging his microphone with him.
Let's move on to the question that people keep writing in to ask. Which of you will be the first one in space?
As we'd been coached, all of us raised our hands. Nicole raised both, just like Parker had. Me? I didn't really care who was first, so long as I got to go. 33.
Two who may land on the moon, selected. IAC names men who may land on the moon. Kansas City, Kansas, July 2nd, 1957. Today, the International Aerospace Coalition named the two astronauts who may become the first humans to set foot on the moon. They are Colonel Stetson Parker of the United States and Captain Jean-Paul Lebourgeois of France, both veterans of the space program. Today, they and Lieutenant Esteban Terrazas of Spain were named as the crew of Artemis 9, which may go to the moon and back in April of next year.
I separated the astronaut candidates into two classes. The men were together for one, and the women for the other. I will admit that the first class they put us into made me a little complacent. Orbital mechanics. That was most of what I had done in the computer department. The other women responded with varying degrees of success. Violette picked it up faster than I had expected. Nicole struggled with basic math and kept forgetting to take the square root or where the decimal place was supposed to be on the slide rule. I helped her where I could, but since I've never struggled with math, it was hard to figure out what to tell her. I just did it. Betty went through the motions, but I think she knew she wasn't going to actually get into space. Maybe she didn't even want to. Sabia worked her way through the orbital mechanics lessons with uneven progress but iron determination. Jacira got it, but also hated it. She frequently muttered under her breath in Portuguese. I didn't speak the language, but I can recognize cursing. When we turned in our first homework assignment, it was like flashing back to being in fourth grade again. The instructor looked mine over and shook his head.
Elma, did Dr. York help you with this?
The room went red and then seemed to cool to freezing. I half expected my breath to steam white. No. He didn't.
It's just, you only have the answers listed here.
He smiled, and his spectacles flashed white in a beam of sunlight.
It's okay to get help, but I still need you to do all the work.
It really was just like fourth grade. Only this time I wasn't going to have to wait, sobbing in the office, for my father to come and rescue me. I'd been too young then to know that there was a simple way to prove that I hadn't cheated on a test.
I understand your concern, so please ask me any question that you'd like and I'll answer it right now.
He tapped the papers together on the desk with a sharp rap.
We don't have time for you to work through an equation. Next time, just do the work.
I ground my teeth together. He wanted me to write out all the in-between steps instead of just solving the equation? Fine. I could take the time to do that, and he could take the time to grade it. I knew how this conversation went. It had happened too many times for me not to know, and I had been an idiot to think that my time at the IAC would count for anything.
Yes, sir.
At that, Nicole stared at me, then raised her hand, smiling.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes, Nicole.
Emma wrote most of those equations.
He sighed.
Thank you, Nicole. I know she wrote the answers, but I needed her to do the work to find them.
She put her hand on her chest and widened her eyes.
Oh, goodness me, I'm so silly.
I cleared my throat before Nicole could go full debutante on him.
What she means, sir, is that in my work at the computer department at the IAC, I originated a good portion of the equations in last night's homework, and the ones that I didn't write, I've used on a daily basis for the past 4 years.
He blinked.
Oh.
He set the pages down and smoothed them.
I see. That would have been useful information to know earlier.
Between dozing through the orbital mechanics classes, we also had advanced pilot training. We were often broken into groups of three and sent to different facilities to use simulators or specialized equipment. Some of it was old hat, like the Dilbert Dunker, which I'd done for flight school as part of the WASPs. But there were some unexpected twists. When I showed up for the Dilbert Dunker with Jasira and Betty, they gave us swimsuits. Specifically, they gave us little blue bikinis. In the dressing room, I held up the skimpy material and frowned. Last time I took this test, we had to do it in a flight suit. Jasira shrugged and unbuttoned her blouse.
I have learned not to be surprised at what Americans do.
Don't look at me.
Betty pulled her blouse off over her head.
I didn't do any advanced training when I was in the WASPs.
Jasira and I exchanged a glance. The application had required 400 hours in high-performance aircraft. I didn't know how they did things in Brazil, but skipping that as a WASP would have been a surprising lack. Regardless of my training, I had a choice of wearing the bikini or doing the test in my clothes, so I pulled the scraps of fabric up and did my best to make sure that they covered everything they were supposed to cover. Maybe they were going to give us the flight suit when we got out of the locker room. Betty finished changing first and headed out of the dressing room. She stopped right outside the bathroom door, then turned around and came back in.
Elma?
Yes.
I grabbed a towel and wrapped it around my midriff in a vague attempt at modesty.
There are reporters here.
Strain tightened her face.
I didn't call them.
Nodding, I continued to secure the towel as if it took all my attention.
Thank you for the warning.
The mill town in my purse whispered promises of calm, but I was about to go through underwater training. I couldn't afford to have my reflexes slowed even a little. Scowling, Betty strode to her bag and pulled out a tube of lipstick.
God damn it. What part of exclusive don't they understand?
Rolling her eyes, Jasira pulled her long dark hair back into a ponytail.
They're about to dunk us underwater?
Many times. And you'll put on lipstick?
Betty shrugged.
With bikinis, it's pretty clear what kind of a test this is going to be. I aim to pass, because I sure as hell ain't going to pass orbital mechanics.
I almost went out the door as I was. I was a physicist and a computer and a pilot, not a pinup girl. And yet, I could hear Mama saying,
"What will people think?"
She had always been on me to gussy up a little. I knew what the rules were for women. God damn it. Turning back to my bag, I slammed it open and dug through to find my own tube of lipstick. The pill case rattled in the bottom of the bag and I hesitated over it. No, I needed my reflexes fast for this test.
I'd survive the press conference, and for most of the trial, there would be thousands of gallons of water between me and the reporters. The silver lipstick tube gleamed in a corner of my bag. It was slick beneath my fingers. I pulled the lid off, twisted it, and applied a thick red coat to my lips. The makeup ladies at Mr. Wizard would be so proud. Jasira watched and shook her head.
No, this is not why my country sent me.
It's not why I'm here either. I capped the tube and straightened. But lipstick won't keep me from doing my job.
Betty snorted. Wearing lipstick practically is my job.
You don't really...
Yep.
She surveyed herself in the mirror and dropped her lipstick back in the bag.
I didn't have the flight hours to make the first cut, but life was able to pull some strings to get me into the testing. After that, that's been all me, but I still owe the devil their due.
Given a choice, would I have made the same bargain? Oh, yes. Yes, I would have. Well, shall we face the devil?
Most of these are just minor demons.
She strutted toward the door.
Wait until life hears about this. Then you'll see the devil incarnate.
I followed her to the door and thanked God for the towel. Cameras snapped and flashes went off as the three of us made our way to the Dilbert Dunker, and I had my first heart-sinking moment of realizing that Betty was right. Let Betty pose for the camera. I focused on the actual test. The Dilbert Dunker sat at the deep end of the pool, up on a stand. The bright red metal cage had a pilot seat inside and sat poised above a set of rails that led into the pool. Ah, I'd spent so many hours learning to escape a water landing that it seemed almost nostalgic. The problem was that training for an underwater escape began in the pool outside the dunker with an obstacle course. They hadn't set one up. They were going to start us with the dunker. We were being set up to fail. The Navy test admins turned around to watch us, or more accurately, to watch Betty. I could hardly blame them. How did she manage to sway like that without coming out of the bikini? The fabric was blue, but you could see it turning red just from the heat of her walk. She stopped in front of the Navy officers with Jasira and me at her back, making an impromptu triangle.
So, who wants to dunk me?
They had to pull Betty out of the cage. Mind you, this wasn't unusual for a first attempt, even with proper training. The thing dropped down a rail at a 50-degree angle, hit freezing water, and then flipped you upside down. You had to unstrap yourself and escape the cage, and they had blinders over your eyes, so you were doing it all by feel. This is why Navy divers were in the pool as a matter of course. Still, I will admit to a certain amount of petty satisfaction at seeing Betty pulled out of the pool like a drowned cat. They wrapped her in a blanket and set her down on a bench while they reset the machine. My satisfaction turned to shame as I watched her shiver. I remembered my first attempt at the dunker. I turned to the Navy officer in charge. Shall I go next? He did not quite roll his eyes, but it was close.
Sure, why not? Let's send all of you in.
And this was what they called training? Trying not to growl, I clambered up the ladder to the dunker's cage. Here I had to let go of my towel and the last scrap of modesty my mother had instilled. As it dropped, flashes went off from the bevy of reporters stationed around the pool. I lowered myself into the cage and nearly shrieked. The cage was metal, including the seat. It had been in a pool of frigid water. I was wearing a bikini. I definitely squeaked, but managed to keep it from being more than that. Still, it was one more reason to wish I were wearing a flight suit. The officer lowered the harness over my shoulders. The cold, damp canvas pressed against my bare flesh as he helped me get buckled in.
All right, sweetheart. This is going to drop into the water and turn upside down. Your job is to not panic until the divers pull you out.
I thought my job was to release myself and swim clear. I ran my hands over the buckle, trying to memorize its position.
Right, that's what I meant.
He slapped the top of the cage and stood up. I leaned out. Blinders? He hesitated and knelt back down.
You done this before?
I was a wasp. Of course, Betty had been too, but I'd flown high-performance aircraft. Ferried Mustangs and most of the fighter planes, so they sent me to Ellington to train.
Huh.
He drummed his fingers on the edge of the cage, then leaned in close.
Okay, listen. They aren't giving you dames the blinders. We were told to just go through the motions. You want to do this for real?
I stared at him for a moment. Just go through the motions? They weren't going to put any of us into space. Somehow, I managed to unlock my jaw. They have me wearing a bikini, but I'm a goddamn pilot. Yes, I want to do this for real.
Hot damn!
He slapped the metal and stood again, leaning over into the control chamber. In a moment, he was back with the black goggles.
Don't drown here.
It wouldn't fit on my agenda. I took the goggles and pulled them on over my hair. The visible world went away. With my hands, I verified the location of the shoulder harness, the cold metal frame of the cage, and the buckle of my waist belt. And then I put my hands on the stick and nodded. Ready? Part of the test is that you don't quite know when they are going to release the cage. I filled my lungs, listening to the hush of fabric as the officer stood. The water lapped below me. A click. And then the seat dropped. Water slapped against me, wrapping me in winter. It pushed at my mouth and clawed the inside of my nose as everything spun. Immediately, my lungs started clamoring for air. Panic did no good. I ground my teeth together and put my hands on my shoulders. There. The rough canvas of the shoulder harness was dead easy to find against my skin. In a flight suit, I used to have to fumble a bit. I followed the line down to the buckle and popped it. The waist belt rubbed against my stomach above the line of the bikini, its buckle a point of ice. I unsnapped it, pushing the two sides apart. Wriggling free of the shoulder harness had been the trickiest part the last time I'd done this, but with the bikini, nothing caught or snagged. I slipped free almost before I was ready. I reached out and caught the edge of the cage with both hands to orient myself. I kicked free of the cage, swimming down and then back away from the wreckage. We were supposed to swim at a 45-degree angle in order to get clear of presumed flames and oil slicks. That was harder to judge when swimming blind, and I suspect I broke the surface too close to the cage. Sound rushed back in as the weight of water fell away.
Fast was that? Was that a record? Elma! Elma, over here!
Inhaling had never felt so good. I pulled the goggles off, smiling at the wall. So I was turned around. That was okay. I needed to do a 360-degree spin with my arms over the water to clear any oil from around me. After spinning in the pool, I turned to face the photographers and waved at them. A record? No. Even if I'd been fast, it was because the variables weren't the same as under normal test conditions. But that was science, and science wasn't what they wanted from me.
34.
2-hour walk in space planned. Artemis 4 astronaut to float 75 feet from capsule. Kansas City, Kansas, November 3rd, 1957. United Press International. Captain Cristiano Zambrano of Mexico will try to set a world spacewalk record of perhaps 2 hours during the forthcoming orbital flight of Artemis 4, the International Aerospace Coalition said today.
Sitting in the simulator after hours, my thick binder of checklists rested heavy on my lap. I massaged the bridge of my nose and squeezed my eyes shut, trying to press the correct sequence into my brain by sheer force. The interior of the simulator was a replica of the actual Artemis capsule and as snug as the cockpit of a fighter. But where there should be a canopy, I instead had a wall and ceiling of switches with arcane acronyms. I'd been hoping that if I studied in the simulator, I might have better recall during an actual sim. No such luck thus far.
You ever coming out of there?
Nathaniel's voice came from below the capsule. I let my head thunk back against the padded seat. B-Mag. With a laugh, Nathaniel climbed the ladder to stand on the small platform outside the capsule.
Pardon?
The flight director attitude indicator is called the FDAI, but the body-mounted attitude gyro is abbreviated BMAG, which is pronounced BMAG. I mean, really? The orbital mechanics and the flight training weren't giving me any trouble. The acronyms, on the other hand, were killing me. And why is that pronounced like word when the commander is CDR? It takes longer to say.
BMAG is faster than BMAG.
You know what I mean? I glared down at the manuals in my lap as if they were Parker. We have whole conversations without any actual nouns. We were doing an LOI burn, and SimSoup dropped the FDAI along with the MTVC. Then the LMP saw BMAG fail, and we had an O2 off-scale low. Ugh.
No one's ever done a manual lunar orbit insertion burn.
You are not helping. I shifted my glare to where Nathaniel stood, framed by the open hatch of the capsule. I was staring straight up at him. He'd nicked a spot under his chin when shaving. And then there's the POGO, the Partial Gravity Simulator, which isn't even an acronym. If any of the women named something that, we'd be laughed out of the astronaut corps, which we are already. Oh, my God. Did I tell you about the photo shoot last week in the T-33?
Yes, but feel free to tell me again if it will help.
Nathaniel leaned an elbow over the edge of the narrow hatch. No, thanks. It still burned, though. I thought they were finally going to let us go up in the T-33s, but all we did was sit in the cockpit and powder our noses. Literally powder our noses. At least when I sat in the capsule, we were doing simulations and learning something. I reached up and took Nathaniel's hand, turning it so I could kiss his palm. Sorry I'm being such a grump.
Tell you what. If you come out of there and help me go over some numbers in a report, I'll drill you on acronyms.
I shut my manual so fast the slap of its pages echoed off the tiny capsule interior. Yes, please, please let me do math. He leaned down and kissed me on the cheek.
Great.
Reaching down, he beckoned for me to give him the manual.
I've been missing you.
Ah, you say the sweetest things. Standing, I wriggled out of the capsule. How some of the men could fit in there with a spacesuit stretched my understanding of physics. Nathaniel leaned against the rail of the tiny platform. Past him, lines of cables and support struts wrapped the capsule in a network of chaotic artistry, designed to simulate missions as closely as possible for the people inside. I stretched until my back popped. The clock on the wall said that it was past 8 o'clock. Apparently, we were having dinner in the cafeteria again. What are you working on?
Nothing complicated. Helen has already done the calculations, but I need to make sure the data reduction is okay before I send it up to the House Appropriations Committee.
He clambered down the ladder with the manual tucked under one arm.
We're looking at what a proposed move to Brazil would do for the engineering department.
I thought that was already approved. I slid down the ladder and hopped the last bit to the floor. Nathaniel sighed.
It was. And then Senator Mason raised questions of national security over whether the United States should cede its power to another country.
I stopped at the foot of the ladder. Is he unclear on what's happening? This is a global effort. There's not going to be a United States of anything if we don't get off this planet.
He doesn't believe it.
Nathaniel walked across the simulator room, shoes clicking on the concrete floor. I followed more quietly. Since joining the astronaut corps, I tended to wear sneakers and trousers to work. The weather has been warming up. Has he not noticed that? He stopped by the bank of light switches.
Yeah, but right now we're in the sweet spot where temperatures feel normal, if a little out of season.
We'd be there for another 5 or more years before things started really running away. That was long enough for people to forget about the meteor. Well, as long as he keeps the funding going to support the space program at home, I suppose that's something.
Right. Better if we're in Brazil, though.
Nathaniel snapped the lights off and held the door to the sim lab for me.
Oh, how's the Brazilian astronaut holding up?
Jacira? She's amazing. The other day, the SimSoup gave us a GPC that was at odds with the MIS. Nathaniel started laughing as the door shut behind him.
Do you hear yourself?
Fair. I glanced down the hall to be sure we were alone, then kissed him. I'm still holding you to drilling me on these, though. I settled into my chair at the Monday morning meeting with a cup of coffee and a donut. There weren't really assigned seats, but habit and routine led us to sit in the same places every time. Maloof's and Binkowski's seats were empty because they were up on a mission, but none of the new astronauts would dare sit there. Jacira, Sabia, Nicole, and I sat together at the right-hand table, farthest from the door. For the most part, women tended to clump together in the crowd of men. although Le Bourgeois and Violette naturally sat together near the back of the room. Betty sat near Parker, up at the front of the room next to Clemens, surrounded by his usual cloud of cigar smoke. An all-important table at the back of the room held the donuts and coffee. I had not realized how much of the man's world was fueled by donuts and coffee. Clemens flipped open the duty roster, which I had come to dread.
All right. Cleary and Le Bourgeois, you're going to head over to ILC to do trials on the newest generation of spacesuit. They think they've solved the binding in the shoulder area, but don't trust them until you've spent the day in it.
Unpleasant, but a fair point. According to all the astronauts, the amount of effort it took to move in a spacesuit became incredibly fatiguing by the end of an EVA. So something that was mildly annoying when you first put it on could become intolerable by the end.
Zambrano and Terrazas, you're still doing simulations with Wells, Taylor, and Sanderson, as per the original schedule. See if you can avoid breaking the IBM this time.
Even I laughed at that. The mechanical computer that was supposed to manage the simulations had an abort rate that would have wiped out most of the astronaut corps if the simulations were real.
Violette, Betty, Granados, and Gladstone, you're in the barrel this week.
He slid a couple of stapled pages across the table. I passed them back, glad I'd dodged that bullet. Being in the barrel meant being on the publicity tour.
Highlights include doing a public school appearance tomorrow and then cutting the ribbon on the reopening of I-70 on Wednesday. Gershon, Wargan, Paz Viveros, Collins, Aldrin, and Armstrong are heading over to Chicago for a date with Adler Planetarium. Time to learn to use the sextant.
Then he turned to me and smiled. That never ended well for me.
York, you and Parker are testing the new T-38 trainer.
I nearly dropped my coffee. The T-38? They hadn't even let me fly the T-33 yet, and I had somehow landed a test flight in the brand new and incredibly sexy T-38? I managed to exchange my urge to say, "Really?" for a more measured, "Yes, sir." Nicole gave me a shove.
Oh, man, you get to have all the fun.
Hey, boss's orders. But it didn't seem possible that keeping my head down and just doing the work had actually changed either man's mind. This was not a gift horse that bore examining, though. I'd been longing to fly the T-38 for, well, basically since it was invented.
Trust me, she won't enjoy this.
Parker pushed back from the table.
Let's get to work, people. We've got a moon to catch.
When I finished changing into my flight suit and parachute, I grabbed my helmet out of its wooden cubby and headed out to the tarmac. My mother would have perished if she could have seen me. Not only was I wearing trousers, but the chute straps ran so tightly through my legs that in some cultures I would be considered married to them. Parker was already at the plane, his helmet propped on the edge of the cockpit. He was chatting with the crew chief, but nodded when he saw me, and swung right into pedantic mode.
The pre-flight check begins as you approach the aircraft.
Which was true of every plane ever flown. I nodded, hoping we could skip that part. Right. Check for oil spills, obstructions, and anything out of the ordinary with the plane. The beautiful, beautiful plane. The jet. From its needle nose back to the exhaust for the jet engine, the T-38 was a thing of streamlined beauty. The IAC planes were made of polished chrome, with the blue and white logo of the IAC emblazoned across the tail. He crossed his arms. Even with his aviator sunglasses in place, I could feel the glare.
I know you think you're a pilot, but a jet is different from a prop plane.
Yes, sir. Smile and nod, Elma. Just smile and nod. I mean, he wasn't wrong. They were different. I'm just eager to put that desk training and simulator time into practice.
All right, then.
He jerked his thumb to the plane.
What's the first thing you do after checking the area?
Check the logs, then the canopy and seat safety pins.
Do it.
He leaned against the wing of the aircraft and made a shooing motion. I checked the tie-down straps for the oxygen hose and the bolts, then hesitated because I really didn't know this plane. What am I missing?
Make sure you check for obstructions.
He headed for the nearest intake with a slight limp. You okay?
You usually have to crouch to get a good line of sight through it like this. Wait.
He lifted his head and beckoned me down.
While you're down here, check this out. Look along the wing.
See how you can see through the body of the plane?
Brilliant. I did, as he told me, peering along the wing of the plane, which was a solid mass in front of me.
Your angle has to be just right. The wings are actually a single piece that goes all the way through the plane.
Seriously? That is... Oh! I saw the glint of light and then a narrow view of the hangar on the far side of the plane. Oh, wow.
All right. This intake's clear, so take a look, then check the other side to see if it matches.
He stepped back, favoring his left leg.
Copy.
Roger. I wanted to push it because a pilot who was injured could directly affect me, but right now, Parker was being nice. Or at least Parker levels of nice. Actually, wait. I have to be fair. When Parker was in pedantic mode, he was a patient and often generous teacher. It was just all the in-between stuff where we clashed. Both sides were clear, and he walked me through checking the intakes for the engines with patience. But when I climbed into the rear cockpit, I had to resist dancing in my seat. It was such a pretty plane. The act of going through every step of the pre-flight checklist helped focus me, especially knowing that Parker was looking for any mistake at all. That's right. I was less worried about a mistake killing me than I was about looking bad in front of Parker. My priorities were perhaps not what they should be. I snugged down my shoulder straps and pulled the helmet into place. The helmet hugged my head and muffled most of the outside world. I connected the oxygen hose, twisting it until it clicked into place, and clipped it to my flight harness. I let the face mask hang open until we were airborne and the oxygen started to flow. For the moment, the canopy stood open, letting in the breeze from the high silver overcast sky. Petrol and tar and the resinous funk of rubber.
All right.
Parker's voice crackled in my ear.
Ready to start the number two engine?
I'm ready.
All danger areas clear?
I leaned to my left to look toward the back of the aircraft. Only the hangar stood behind us, and it was far enough back to be clear. Then I strained against the shoulder harness and checked behind us on the right. All clear. In front of me, Parker went through the same motions. All I could really see was the dome of his helmet as he settled back in his seat and nodded.
Let's signal for air. Hands clear?
In demonstration, he lifted his hands over his head, one fist pressed against the middle of his other palm. It wouldn't do to accidentally hurt our crew chief by bumping something. My hands are clear. They were clear, but my pulse was steadily speeding up. I took a slow breath to calm down. If I got this excited about a jet, a rocket would do me in. Outside the jet, our ground crew ran back to feed air in to assist the engine ignition. From inside the craft, the whoosh of air rose to a steady whine.
30 number two. There's 14% RPM. Ready tack. Throttle to idle.
The throttle matched the movement he was doing in the front and moved up. I wouldn't do anything until he switched control over to me, but I could pretend that my actions were powering the jet. At least for a little while. Parker kept up a steady monologue, letting me know what he was doing.
Fuel flow is 200. Oil pressure is indicating. EGT rising.
So was my blood pressure. He was actually going to take me up in the jet.
770 peak. Engine instruments look good. Hydraulics look good. Caution lights are out. Crossover is good.
He paused. His helmet turned a little as if waiting for a response. There's this weird thing in flying that makes it almost like a religion. Pilots do call and response as a liturgy of our own. My engine instruments are good. Hydraulics check good. Caution lights are out.
Clear left.
I checked again. Clear.
Okay. Let's divert air to number one. Hands clear?
Parker lifted his hands over his head. My hands are clear. Outside, the ground crew ran to switch the hose to the number two engine. Again, I had to marvel at the difference between Parker the teacher and Parker the asshole. His voice through all of this was calm and patient.
Ready to start number one?
Ready. My voice, on the other hand, might have cracked a little. It was all I could do not to cackle with glee as the aircraft came alive beneath us. We went through the same checks for the number one engine, and by the end of it, I had almost matched the calmness of Parker's voice.
Throttle gate is engaged. Okay. Let's disconnect air.
He lifted his hands over his head.
Hands clear?
My hands are clear. They were clear of all instruments and, somewhat remarkably, not shaking. All of my nerves seemed to be vibrating, but it didn't show in my hands. Jets are infinitely easier than crowds and much, much more alluring. When the ground crew pulled the hose away from the engine, Parker resumed his litany.
Battery switch checks out. Good start.
We went through the pre-taxi checks and nav checks with the same call and response. Then we got to...
Time to pull the canopy and seat pins.
Canopy and seat pins pulled? The bright orange plastic came out easily. I lifted them both over my head to demonstrate that I'd done it before stowing them in the pocket by my left knee.
Chalk's clear.
Outside, the crew followed his hand signals. We began to taxi. A plane on the ground is an ungainly thing. It jostled me against my shoulder straps, but I followed along with Parker as we went through the rest of the nav and comm checklists during taxi.
Arms clear.
He lowered the canopies and cut off the breeze from the outside. My God. Even in the rear seat, the plane had such a wide field of vision. What must it have been like in front? The tower came over our radio.
Talon 1-1 Tower, you are cleared for takeoff.
Parker's head turned a little as if he could look over his shoulder to see me.
You ready?
Confirmed ready. He nodded and replied to the tower.
Talon 1-1, cleared for takeoff.
Parker brought the jet up to full military power and lit the afterburner. The jet jolted like someone had kicked me in the pants. He released the brakes and popped the burners. The engine whine rose in pitch as the jet rolled forward, forcing me back into my seat. It wasn't like a prop plane, where the force is almost gentle. This thundered through me, dragging my back into the seat. She lifted off the runway so smoothly I almost clapped as the ground fell away. But this was a training flight, not a tourist ride, so my delight stayed inside. I watched the gauges and the world outside. It was like the air had become liquid and flowed around us. How can you feel heavy and light at the same time? The G-force of takeoff pressed me into my seat, but the air held me up. God, this was a beautiful plane. My love for it probably broke all the rules about worshiping graven images.
York.
Parker banked to the south and pressed me further into my seat. Sir? He wasn't going to offer to let me take the stick, was he? Not yet.
I have a problem, and I need a favor.
Come again?
You heard me.
The asshole Parker returned for a moment, and then he sighed. There's an intimacy to the sound of another pilot in your ear.
Look, you and Maloof are the only two who know about the thing with my leg.
Where was this going? I haven't told anyone.
I know.
He sighed again.
Thank you.
What? Everything about this conversation confused me. He couldn't have said this on the ground? For that matter, why hadn't Maloof reported him? May I ask what's going on? Above the canopy, the clouds sank toward us, changing from a featureless expanse of silver gray to crenellations of cotton. Parker took us up into them, and the wisps brushed past, feathering away as we ripped through. The jet punched out of the upper level of clouds into blue sky. God! It was not profanity. It had been so long since I had seen clear blue. It ached, that blue. The unobscured sun flared across the clouds and brought tears to my eyes, even with my visor.
Yeah.
Parker sighed again.
This is amazing, but space. I need to see a doctor. My leg goes pins and needles and then randomly just stops working. They'll ground me if they even suspect something is wrong.
So go to a doctor who's not a flight surgeon. Parker gave the bitterest laugh I'd heard from him.
You think I haven't tried? I'm the first man into space. I can't go anywhere without reporters following me. I can't sneeze. I can't play ball with my sons. I can't even visit my...
He stopped talking, leaving only the hiss of oxygen, the sound of my own breathing, and the rush of air around us. Can't visit your...
Can't visit my doctor.
Pretty sure that hadn't been what he was going to say.
If I certify you on the T-38, will you let me use the flights to mask my visits to a doctor?
I asked questions to buy time. How will that work exactly? I mean, you're not going to let me go up on my own.
No, but there's a clinic. We land near it, I go in, I come back out, we keep flying.
Just the T-38? You're not offering me a seat on a rocket?
Can't.
His helmet turned as if he wanted to look back at me.
I get some say in that, but not the final word. If I did, gotta be honest, there wouldn't be any women in the program at all. Not yet.
You know I've logged more flight hours than you, right?
Yes. And I know about the Messerschmitts and the target practice and all the other things you WASP did. None of that matches what a test pilot does, and it sure as hell doesn't match what we do up there.
Well, we can't know that, can we? Besides, how hard can it be if you can do it with a bum leg? He put the plane into a roll as if that proved some sort of point. I laughed, giggled, really. Sorry, wait, I wasn't laughing at you. It's just, the plane is beautiful.
She really is.
He leveled the T-38 out and left us nearly floating in our seats.
So, will you do it?
You still hate me?
Yep.
He sighed again, which was such an odd sound coming from him. It was as if he had to let his ego leak out before he could keep talking.
But I acknowledge that you will keep your word and are principled.
And you aren't worried that those principles will lead me to report you?
I am.
The problem is that you're asking me to risk lives and jeopardize the program.
I've kept myself off crew lists. But there's a difference between deferring missions and being grounded.
And now they want you to go to the moon. The thing that was tempting about his proposition wasn't the T-38. It was the chance to finally be in his good graces, even if he resented me for it. I don't know. Maybe before I'd been in the program, I would have been able to take him up on the deal. But now? Now I knew exactly how fit you had to be as an astronaut. To say nothing of what would happen if I got caught colluding. I won't tell anyone, but I'm sorry. I can't help you hide it. The air hissed past in our silence.
Well, you're honest. I'll give you that. Okay.
Parker's head dipped forward and then lifted.
I know about the Milltown.
35. Hurricane data sought. 3 UN planes detailed for research work. Paris, November 3rd, 1957. 3 United Nations planes will be detailed for special hurricane research work next summer and fall, officials said today. The United States Air Force will supply the United Nations with 2 B-50 Superforts and a B-47 Stratojet for the project. They will fly the Atlantic, Caribbean, and the Gulf of Mexico as part of an ongoing effort to understand how weather patterns have shifted since the meteor strike in 1952.
How do you tell your husband that you're being blackmailed? Over dinner? Say, sweetie, a funny thing happened to me today, pass the salad? Maybe in bed, while distracting him with sex. Or you could just blurt it out while brushing your teeth. Parker's trying to blackmail me. Nathaniel pulled the floss out of his mouth and turned.
What?
He knows about the Milltown and wants my help with something.
What?
Same word, totally different meaning. His hands were clenched so tightly around the floss that it cut into the sides of his fingers, turning them dead white. I swallowed, and the minty freshness made my stomach turn over in sour knots. I drew a full breath that burned cold. The knot of anxiety in my chest would have sent me reaching for a Milltown, but not now. Damn, Parker. You can't tell anyone. This is why I hadn't told him at work. If I had, he would have stormed into Clemens's office and made demands about Parker's attempts at blackmail.
Clemens has to know.
The tips of his fingers past the floss had begun to go purple. Setting my toothbrush in the holder, I sighed. Let's sit down. Nathaniel looked down and blinked at the floss. He uncurled it, flexing his fingers, and dropped it into the waste bin.
Okay.
By the time we got to the sofa, trembles shook my arms and sweat coated my back. I swallowed and stared at my hands, which I held in a relaxed and ladylike posture on my lap. Mama would be so proud. If you tell anyone, then Clemens will know about the mill town and my anxiety and the vomiting. And then what will he think? That I'm fit to go into space? That I'm even fit for the program? He already thinks I'm a publicity stunt.
Who told you that?
The sofa creaked as he leaned forward.
Parker.
I nodded. Nathaniel pushed himself off the sofa and paced to the Murphy bed and back. He stopped in front of the coffee table, legs spread and hands on his hips.
Tell me what happened.
Promise me that you won't tell anyone. Tendons jumped under the skin on the backs of my hands, but I didn't clench them into fists or do anything. His body stayed rigidly still, but he turned to stare out the window at the lights of Kansas.
I can promise you that I will talk with you before doing anything. I can't promise to do nothing, because that is a promise I won't keep.
I rubbed my thumb on one of the muscles that kept twitching. Why I bothered, I don't know, since my entire body was trembling with stress. He's been having trouble with his left leg. Pins and needles, he says. A couple of months ago, I caught him in the stairwell and he couldn't stand. Asked me not to tell. Later, it looked like it had gone away, so I thought it was temporary. And it had felt safer to keep waiting for someone else to see his symptoms. I could chalk my silence up to prudence or compassion, but it had been largely fear. Drawing another breath, I told Nathaniel about the flight, and the request, and then the demand. He took me with him to the clinic. I think he didn't want me out of his sight.
Into the examining room?
Nathaniel's voice cracked. No, no. Just the lobby. There had been a phone at the nurse's station, and I'd nearly called Nathaniel from there. Thank God I hadn't. When Parker came out, he was green, and he stopped in the bathroom to throw up. The problem with small clinics is that the walls are thin. I am all too familiar with the sound of retching. After another 5 minutes, he came out. He was pale, but not green, and he'd put his aviators on. I had some guesses about why he was wearing sunglasses inside. My eyes always got red after a bout of vomiting. Nathaniel grunted.
So the news is bad. Did he tell you what?
I shook my head. I didn't ask. I let him pretend that everything was fine.
That was kinder than he deserved.
I shook my head. I just didn't want to feel sorry for him.
Anything else?
He let me have the controls of the T-38 on the way back. I guess it was a reward or something. My fingers had gone to ice. How could I be sweating and cold at the same time? So, that's it. Back at the IAC, it was like nothing had happened. Nathaniel grunted again and turned back to pacing. He's tall, my husband, and our apartment doesn't give him a lot of ground to cover. With the Murphy bed down, he had even less. He finally stopped in front of the window, staring out.
I could force the issue. With the Sirius coming online, the G-forces of takeoff are going to be harsher than with the Jupiter. I could insist on physicals for all the astronauts.
He would see through that.
I'm not going to have him jeopardize the program or the people in it for the sake of his ego.
Or for mine, for that matter. Nathaniel didn't say it, but here we came to the problem. I didn't want anyone to know that I had anxiety. While some of that was fear that they wouldn't let me go into space, the rest of it was the same old concern. What would people think? And then beneath that, the fear that they were right. He's been deferring missions while he tried to figure out what was going on.
But now there's the moon.
The streetlights lit his hair into a corona.
You really think he's going to defer that?
I shook my head. I've been thinking about it all day. I'll have to get rid of the pills, that's for certain, and stop seeing the doctor. The more time between my last refill and when Parker outs me, the better. He will, though. Not immediately, because if he did, I would have no reason to keep silent. Nathaniel's head snapped back to me.
That seems like a very bad idea.
What else am I supposed to do? I spread my hands, but my fingers were shaking, so I rested them in my lap again. He knows. I don't know how, but he does. With a grunt, Nathaniel turned to Pace again.
The driver. That night we stayed in a hotel because of the reporters. I sent a driver to pick up our clothes and your prescription.
So it wasn't just Parker who knew. How long? How long before everyone knew and I got booted from the program and it went into the papers and my stomach lurched and twisted in time with my thoughts. I staggered to my feet and barely made it to the bathroom before losing it. Huddled on the bathroom tiles, I clutched the toilet and retched. Nathaniel came in behind me and held my shoulders as all of the accumulated anxiety of the day heaved out of me, and I hated myself. Daddy would have been so disappointed in me, unable to handle a little pressure. If I couldn't handle this, maybe I shouldn't be in the space program. I was stupid and weak, and it didn't matter how hard I worked. The sickness would always be a part of me. Nathaniel filled the tumbler from the bathroom sink with water and held it out to me.
I won't let anyone hurt you.
How will you stop him? My throat hurt as I spoke, but I took the water and swallowed.
I don't know.
He ran a hand over my hair and down my back.
Not all of it, at any rate.
I don't even know part of it. I rocked back to sit on the floor, leaning against the side of the tub. Nathaniel stood and opened the medicine cabinet. No. My fingers tightened around the tumbler. Ignoring me, Nathaniel pulled out the bottle of Milltown and crouched in front of me.
Elma, is this better? Throwing up and being miserable? Is that better than whatever it is Parker could do to you?
I don't... My voice fractured on the pain in my throat. I don't know.
Then let me tell you what I see.
Nathaniel shifted to squeeze in next to me against the tub. He put an arm around my shoulders and pulled me against him, the pill bottle in one hand. Okay.
You're better. With this. I was so, so worried about you before.
He shook the bottle so the pills rattled inside it.
Before this. I could hear when you threw up. You'd stopped eating. We went to bed together, but you didn't sleep. And you weren't talking to me about any of it. I thought you might be pregnant until that day in my office. I was really frightened for you. And right now, the idea that Parker might put you through that deliberately because he's made you afraid to use a tool that helps. I would like to punch him.
That last sentence was so matter-of-fact that a laugh surprised its way out of me. Wiping my eyes with the back of my hand, I looked up at Nathaniel, but his eyes were squeezed shut, a crease carved between his brows. You aren't kidding. He let his breath out in a controlled stream.
No.
Rolling the bottle in his fingers, he shook his head.
I have never had such a strong urge for violence. If I had been there, I probably would have punched him, and then he would have beaten the tar out of me.
With each revolution of the bottle, the little white pills inside rattled and shifted. Their tiny clatter promised a blanket of soothing calm. I don't know what to do.
Do you think the pressure is going to get any lighter?
Sighing, I folded in on myself and sagged against Nathaniel. He pulled me tight, pressing his lips against the top of my head.
Here's what I think. You keep yourself healthy, and then we can deal with Parker. Together. I don't know how, but I know we can.
How can you be so sure?
Because we survived the end of the world.
He kissed me again.
And you are my lady astronaut.
I followed Nicole's maid back to her sunken living room, where most of the 99s were munching on hors d'oeuvres and sipping cocktails. Jasira and Sabia had joined the mix, but I didn't see Betty or Violette. "Sorry I'm late," Aunt Esther called, and it took a while to get off the phone.
"How is the dear?"
Nicole rose from the arm of the sofa she was perched on, leaving Imogene with her head bowed over a flight manual.
"Martini?"
"Please." The glory of knowing a senator's wife was that liquor was never lacking at the Wargan House. I'd taken the Milltown out of my purse, but hadn't gotten rid of it, and having something to take the edge off seemed very appealing. Helen bounded across the room to hug me, still holding the manual she'd been studying.
"Missed you."
"Me too. Maybe we can grab dinner sometime?" I'd gone past the computer department a couple of times after my promotion, as they called it, but it had been awkward. I kept wanting to check numbers, but that would just annoy everyone.
"What are you reading?"
She shrugged.
"It's just orbital trajectory calculations. Pretty basic."
"Basic for you?"
Nicole handed me a martini with a laugh.
"Some of us struggle with that stuff."
"That's why we trade. You teach me about simulator, I teach you about orbital calculations."
I raised my glass. "And if someone can get the acronyms through my head, I would be greatly appreciative." The clear, cold gin lit up my mouth with all its juniper glory. I closed my eyes and sighed with appreciation as my shoulders relaxed just a smidge. I'd missed these women. Thank God Nicole had thought about setting up a study group. Opening my eyes, I carried my cocktail and my books over to join Helen on the sofa. Kicking off my shoes, I settled down and tucked my feet up under me. "No Pearl?" Helen shook her head and scowled.
"She doesn't think there's any point in prepping for the astronaut tests."
"They have to open it up more widely at some point, if it's really going to be a colonization effort." From her spot on the sofa, Nicole nodded.
"And that's something my husband strongly supports."
"Wait." I blinked, feeling like I'd missed something. "Are they still talking about keeping it a military venture?" With a sigh, Nicole scooted forward to face me.
"I know you hate the idea, but..."
"But nothing. We have to get off the planet. I mean, sure, they might, and I stress the word might, be able to keep the greenhouse effect from running away, but by the time we know if that's going to work, it'll be too late to try to establish colonies elsewhere. We have to do it now, while we have the resources and the time."
"Preaching to the choir."
Nicole smoothed the pages of her book, then reached for her martini. She took a sip of it before she continued. All of us, it wasn't just me, were staring at her, waiting to see what she was going to say.
"But there are members of Congress, and in fact of the UN, who only respond to questions of military threat. So if having a military component to the missions is useful in getting funding and keeping the program going, then that's what my husband will do."
"That's... why are people so stupid?" Nicole shrugged and unbuttoned her blouse by one.
"Hormones. And if men are going to be led by them, then I'm happy to play my part."
Ida raised her glass. "Hear, hear."
"How are you ladies doing this evening?"
Poor Senator Wargan chose that moment to wander into the living room. I'm pretty sure he wasn't used to a room full of women laughing at him, but he didn't seem to mind.
"Does anyone know what an MITTS is?"
Jasira looked up from the binders she had been studying. She'd stretched out on the floor with her legs kicked up behind her. That was all I could offer.
"Mobile Igor Tracking Telescope System,"
Ida said, without even looking up from the book she had open. She tapped the pencil against the edge of the page as she read.
"Seriously? An acronym within an acronym?"
I tilted my head back to glare at the ceiling. "I'm trying to remember what Igor means."
"Intercept Ground Optical Recorder."
Why the hell wasn't she in the astronaut corps already? I mean, besides the color of her skin.
"You should be in the program."
Ida snorted, but didn't look up. Her pencil beat a faster rhythm on the pages.
"The application rules are such obvious baloney. If they could bend them for Violette and Betty, then..."
"Elma?"
Nicole shook her head.
"Come on."
All the frustration of the past months rolled out of me.
"Violette barely had 100 solo flight hours when she applied."
Ida dropped her book.
"You did not just say that."
"Yeah. You want to give Dr. King some ammunition?
You tell him to look into the flight records of Violette Lebourgeois and Betty Rawls. Violette's in because she's French and her husband is one of the astronauts. Married couple in space makes a nice story, right?
Nicole closed her book.
You're not wrong, and you're not right either.
It's discrimination, pure and simple.
It was, too.
Betty's only in because they wanted to control the publicity, and life gave them a way to do so. Those two spots should have gone to the most qualified candidates.
You think I was the best candidate they saw? You think you were?
Nicole shook her head again, her eyes glittering.
I'm good. I qualified. But my husband is also a senator, and one who's been backing the IAC since day one. Jacira was a beauty contest queen.
With a master's in engineering.
I didn't like where she was going with this. She was undercutting the very real qualifications these women had. And I didn't want her to get to me. From the floor, Jacira pushed up to sit and crossed her legs in front of her.
Yes, but I was not the only Brazilian woman with a pilot's license and an engineering degree. Granted, there are only four of us, but I was not the one with the most flight time.
And I was Mr. Wizard's lady astronaut.
It's all about the story that the IAC wants to tell.
Nicole shrugged and took a sip of her martini.
That's what politics is. Stories.
And the story that they want to tell doesn't include black people? I winced, realizing I'd cut Helen out of the equation. Or Taiwanese? Just white people? Ida shrugged and closed her book with a thump.
Same old story, just another chapter.
She stood up and stretched.
I'd better call it a night.
A chorus of yawns and agreements met her, and the party broke up. As I put on my hat and pulled on my gloves, I kept wanting to rant about the unfairness of it. But I didn't. Ida had made it pretty clear that she was done with the topic. And then there was the other nagging thought. The thing is, I don't know how much of my anger was a desire to help the black cause, and how much was because I wanted to get Violette and Betty out of my way.
36.
Dr. King charges IAC with discrimination. Special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, November 22nd, 1957. Amid allegations that two of the so-called lady astronauts were not qualified for the program, a Southern Negro minister has charged the International Aerospace Coalition with discrimination. The United Nations Governing Committee has convened a special hearing to discuss the truth of the charges. Director Norman Clemmons has stated that the two women were part of a pilot program to see if mission specialists could be trained for the space program without the rigid requirements of the early astronauts, something that would be necessary, he said, for the establishment of colonies.
The Mastiff is at once a joy and a bane, and not just because it's another acronym. The Multi-Axis Space Test Inertia Facility, or Gimbal Rig, is a giant thing that a mad scientist designed. I might even mean that literally. Certainly it would look at home as a torture device in some underground lair. At the moment, Nicole was strapped into the chair at the heart of it. The rigid plastic chair was a replica of the Artemis astronaut couches, except that her head was strapped in a fixed position. Surrounding the chair were aluminum tubes that formed a three-axis gimbal rig. I say aluminum tubes, but they were really more like cages. Each one could move independently of the others, tumbling the chair over on the roll, pitch, and yaw axes. Right now, Nicole was rotating at a leisurely 15 RPM, but the thing could get up to 30 RPM. In theory, it gave us a sense of the sort of tumbling that might happen during a space mission, although if anyone were ever tumbling at 30 RPM, something would have gone terribly, terribly wrong. I leaned against the wall of the control room, waiting with Jacira and Betty for our turn. An actual scientist ran the test, but our evaluation was done by one of the other astronauts, which is why Parker stood at the observation window with a stopwatch in one hand. Betty stood next to Parker and tried to seem relaxed, but she had too much makeup on, which did nothing to mask the puffy bags under her eyes. I gathered from water cooler chatter that her testimony at the UN hearings about the discrimination charges had been rough. It was hard not to feel bad for her. A nitrogen gas jet hissed as Nicole tried to cancel out the rotation. It looked like she was going for pitch first. The jet popped and fired again. A whole series of cameras chattered along with it. I'd left the mill town at home because I couldn't risk having my reflexes slowed for this test. My stomach turned knots even before I got into the chair. At least they'd made the reporters stop using flashes in here, though I suppose you could argue that the strobing would be good practice for being disoriented in space. My right hand